The Armed Forces Radio Service invites you to share in the vivid, colorful stories just between us. Stories as told by one of America's master yarn spinners, Knox Manning.
This is Knox Manning with a few remarks just between us about mysterious ponies, water, a radio-controlled lifeboat, your heart, and a little something on pain. Toward the middle of summer, a band of mystery ponies are rounded up on the uninhabited island of Assateague, a sliver of rock and sand 4 miles off the Virginia coast. The stumpy animals are driven across a shallow channel to the island of Chincoteague and herded into a corral. The next day, the ponies, whose owners know almost nothing about the animal's origin, are auctioned off at prices ranging from $10 to $100. The buyers will be among some 15,000 tourists on the island to witness Chincoteague's 101st Pony Penning Day. Pony Penning Day was probably first held about 1700. Its modern popularity is best explained by the ponies' mysterious background. Nobody knows where they came from or how they got on the island. Then there is a denser riddle. What are the ponies? Horses or ponies? These are the only type of its kind in the world. The ponies average only 4 1/3 feet in height, which is slightly taller than the Shetland pony, but much smaller than a horse. They're faster than most horses, less docile than ponies. The pony or horse question has been answered in many ways. The Chincoteague pony is a remnant of the prehistoric wild horse. North America swarmed with horses up until 30,000 years ago. Then they were wiped out, probably by disease. There were no more horses on the continent until the Spanish imported them. The island's ponies are descendants of the prehistoric horses, saved from disease by their complete isolation. Other theories are, since a shipwreck explains the origin of Chincoteague's first settlers, it seems a plausible explanation. About 1618, three brothers named Wheelton sailed from England to America. Off the main coast, their ship was wrecked. The brothers survived. But did they have horses in the first settlement? But it's doubtful if the horses swam from Maine to Chincoteague. This is giving the horses too much credit. To answer the long-distance swim question, other islanders employ a Spanish galleon tale. According to this story, the galleon sank on the rocks near the island. But this theory also sinks when the tourist asks, what happened to the Spanish sailors? It's improbable that they all died so close to land, especially when the horses reached the shore. So the theories go on. The Chincoteague pony riddle will probably remain a thought-provoking game for the amateur husbandman, a minor but curious footnote in history books, but still a riddle. And while we're on the subject, riddles, here's one for you. How much water should you drink? If you should ask 20 different people, chances are you'd get 20 different answers. If you ask the question on a hot day, one person will be sure to tell you to drink a lot of water to keep cool, and the next person will tell you to drink as little as possible so that you won't perspire so much. At the dinner table, a mother will tell the children not to drink so much water, that it's downright unhealthy. Some woman complains about being overweight and is advised to cut down on drinking water. And there are those in the world who seem to be afraid to drink any water at all, believing that it'll rust their iron constitution. They drink alcohol instead. The truth about the water drinking has got a lot of hard-to-believe facts in it. Your body is not only filled up to 66% with water, but with salt water at that. And there's a reason for that. As animals developed and came from the ocean onto the land, they brought the salt water with them. They'd been adapted to it. It was a part of them, so they just kept it. And now we can't live without that salt as a part of our diet. But leaving the salt out of the picture entirely, we've still got that 66% water to account for, and the little matter of keeping it replaced as fast as we lose it. And we really lose it. We lose about a pint a day in just breathing. Just blow your breath in a glass and see the moisture left there. If you breathed in a glass all day, you'd collect a pint of water in that glass. And we lose twice that much through the skin, just with invisible perspiration. And when we exercise enough to be able to see the water coming through our pores, that's just extra loss. Add to that the fact that normal internal elimination costs another quart per day, and the total loss on the part of the average adult is 3 quarts of water per day. The natural question that follows is, well, you don't expect me to drink 3 quarts of water each day, do you? And the answer is, certainly not. The water you get is going to come from the food you eat, rather than from the water you drink. There are few foods you can find that don't have a high percentage of water. Peanut butter, crackers, and dried coconut don't have much water, but most of the others have a very high percentage. You'd be surprised. Even the things that you consider pretty solid foods, like beans, baked beans, are from 68 to 70% water. Corned beef is from 50 to 62% water. Cooked chicken will run as high as 65% water, and cooked beef from 50 to 62%. Whole eggs are from 73% to 75% water. Bananas, 75%. Good, sturdy old beef stew, the kind that sticks to your ribs. It'll have to do a lot of sticking because its rating is from 83 to 88% water. Even a dry food like cake will assay 25% water. So actually, you drink while you eat. If you lived on fruits and vegetables, you could go a long, long time without a drink. You could pull a camel act and go the camel one better. What water you drink will depend on the simple matter of drinking when you're thirsty and not over-drinking. A little at a time rather than a lot at once. Give the liquid a chance to move on. And don't get to thinking too much about that 66% water which you are. It's weakening to consider, and it doesn't make you a drip. And while we're on this wet subject, let's take a big body of water. Now let's add a disabled plane which has crashed in the water. Now, what happens? Well, a radio-controlled lifeboat will chug up, stand by while the survivors board her, and then sail away on a gyro-compass course for the nearest land or ship, completely guided by the operator in the Air Force SB-29 rescue plane which dropped the lifeboat. That's one of the latest developments in air rescue work. Before this, the boat was dropped in the vicinity of the survivors with an allowance for drift. If all went well, the survivors' raft drifted down to the boat. But now, with the new radio control system, the boat will come to them. After the lifeboat is dropped, the operator in the airplane takes over on a five-frequency transmitter, which is matched by a receiver in the boat. This way, he can completely control the speed and course of the boat. He stops it when it comes up to the survivor's raft and idles the motor while they board. Then he sets the A3 on its course. The boat itself is equipped with a duplicate set of controls and a manual override, which would enable the survivors to break off the radio control at any time they may wish. The lifeboat has a walkie-talkie radio set for communication between the rescued men and the plane. There are rations, survivor equipment, and gasoline enough to cruise 800 miles. If the distance is greater than that, the boat can be resupplied from the air since its present course will be known. So there it is again, another step in the forward strides taken by the armed forces for the benefit of the men in the service. Well, you know, the heart is the one organ in your body that begins to function long before birth and stops only at the moment of death. And your heart will tell what kind of a life you lead. Basically, the heart is a pump. It circulates the blood through a long, complicated system of tubes, the arteries, veins, and capillaries. When it expands, the blood flows out through various valves, makes its way to the lungs, gives up its carbon dioxide, and returns carrying oxygen for the tissues of the body. Since the heart's own muscles also require oxygen, they have their own arteries, which take up 1/20th of the entire blood volume. The tubes that carry blood to the muscles of the heart are called coronary blood vessels. Any disturbance in the circulation of the blood through these vessels causes serious incapacity and often a great deal of pain. If the blood then clots, the clot appears in the heart after death. The heart of a child at birth weighs less than an ounce. The heart of an adult weighs at least half a pound. The heart beats 100 times a minute in a small child and 60 to 80 times a minute in an adult. This pump can circulate 500 gallons of blood a day. In 1900, heart disease was third after tuberculosis and pneumonia among causes of death in the United States. By 1929, it was first, and still is. One reason, of course, is the tremendous improvement in controlling the infectious diseases of childhood and adolescence. But the research that helped to stamp out those infectious diseases is the same kind of research that could help us to prevent conditions that interfere with the heart and cause untimely death. Such conditions are many. They can be classified by their causes, the changes they produce in the body, their relationship to other diseases, the methods of control and treatment, and their likelihood of destroying vocational ability or life itself. As the child grows to maturity, it enters a competitive world. Life today is a grinding struggle for success. Perhaps the mind, nerves, and blood vessels of men were never constituted for modern-day stresses. Perhaps the machine age is too much for the human machine. In any event, too many leaders in our society die far too young of the disease that affects the heart. Some men seem more intelligent about living than others. Some have lived to well-advanced years and continued extraordinary careers. Take former Chief Justice Hughes, active past 80. Dr. W.W. Keene, who conducted an active campaign in behalf of medical research when he was past 90. Goethe wrote Faust at 80. Titian painted the Battle of Lepanto at 98. We need to know the factors that make for long life and effectiveness in the years beyond 70. This should be a challenge not only to the doctor and the researcher, but to you, too, as a human being. Your heart tells how you live, and how you live may well decide how long you live. And while we're on the subject of living, it seems that there are a lot of folks that go around in pain every day, in pain all the time, and say nothing about it. Maybe you have your aches, too. Somehow we seem to get used to pain. That's a fact. We even forget about it at times. It's still there, because when we stop thinking about something else, why, there it is. But those people, the ones who hurt all the time, they don't seem to be afraid of pain anymore. And the funny thing is that the people that pain pains most is the people who haven't got any pains. Maybe I better say that over. The people that pain hurts most is the people who haven't got any pains. It's the fear of pains that's so darned uncomfortable. We're scared it might hurt, and it does hurt. Let me tell you something that might be comforting to you. It was to me when I found it out. If you've lived the normal life and have the usual number of cuts and bruises and aches and burns that such a life entitles you to have, you've suffered as much pain as you ever will, no matter what happens. For example, if you were to wake up some night in a cold sweat having dreamed that you're burned at the stake, forget it. You dreamed that it hurt something awful. But if you were to hold one finger in a flame, and most of us have had burns as bad as that, that one finger would hurt just as bad as if you were burned at the stake. The pain would be just as intense. Increasing the area in which pain is caused does not increase the pain. The medical men have proved that. Sure, if you're hurt badly in a number of places, you may not be able to hold up under it as well as if you're just hurt in one place, but the pain is actually no worse. And if it gets too bad, nature has a way of taking care of that by administering a general anesthetic, robbing him of all pain. Fainting is one name for it. When it hurts too bad for you to stand it any longer, the recording center of your brain just decides to close up shop and you go into a state of shock. But there's even a more effective painkiller than either shock or morphine, one that works every day and all of the time. The learned men call this the high interest level. Right down to earth, it's nothing more than being interested in something else more than we are in the pain. What happens to a prize fighter is typical of that so-called high interest level. They get hit and hurt. Hit hard and hurt badly and never know it. They're so intent on what they're doing that when pain is reported to their minds, the report is just pushed aside, out of the range of their consciousness. At the moment, they have more compelling things to do than just to hurt. And you know, there are some very few people who are completely insensitive to pain. You can cut them or bruise them or stick a nail in them and it just doesn't hurt. With those people, a small part of their brain is blocked off, and that blocking kills the consciousness of pain. But that isn't as wonderful as it sounds. Many times, a pain is a helpful sign that something is wrong and should be checked by a competent medical person. So, like it or not, you see that it is a good thing that we can experience some pain. But in the meantime, remember that you've already suffered as much as you'll suffer if you live to be 1,000, and don't fear pain. That's a part of the picture. You got a good friend on your side and Mother Nature. But just between us, that's it for today.
You've been listening to Knox Manning in another of his informative and entertaining programs of storytelling. Any comments regarding the program should be addressed to Knox Manning, Armed Forces Radio, Los Angeles, USA. Remember, all the stories told are just between us. This program was produced by Carl Hoffenberg. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.